Here, this little girl from Ohio, over the course of years, is now this big sex symbol. And according to books that have been written about her, she could not come to terms with her own public image. In other words, she had been brought up, and her life had gone in such a direction that she had this public persona of being this beautiful sex object, and there was still Norma Jean Baker there inside her that had a hard time coming to terms with that. And it's what killed her in the end. And, says this theologian, isn't that a shame? And wouldn't it have been nice if Norma Jean Baker could have learned to live with some kind of grace and some kind of comfort as a public figure? And, he said, that is always what is happening to faith. Faith is always at the point of being murdered by religion, by its religious embodiment. Am I making any sense to you? Faith is this personal relationship between you and God and you and your brothers and sisters. And you have to work that out somehow. And as I tell my classes at seminary, you have to work it out in what I call the four C's: creed, code, cult, and, would you even believe, constitution. And all of that stuff, creed, code, cult, and constitution — creed, of course, is doctrines. Code, of course, is ethics, behavior. Cult, that's worship, what we're talking about. And constitution, that's church structure. Boy, a lot of T's in that word. Anyhow, creed, code, cult, and constitution represents religion, the outward form that faith always and necessarily has to take. You cannot have faith without these things. Where two or three are gathered together, says Jesus, there am I in the midst of them, and there you will find a president, a vice president, and a treasurer. Right? I mean, you can't do without it. And as I argued a couple days ago in these sessions, everybody has a liturgy. Everybody has a way of worship. Even the churches that call themselves non-liturgical churches are kidding themselves. They are liturgical. It's just that they got a different liturgy. And the problem with our liturgies is the same as our problem with constitutions and church structure, and the same with ethics and moral codes and systems of behavior, and the same with doctrines and creeds and teachings and dogmas and that kind of stuff. Namely, all of that stuff can get in the way of faith and murder faith, the way Norma Jean Baker was murdered by Marilyn Monroe, her public embodiment. Now, we have an embodied faith, and we have to deal with all this stuff. And in our session tonight, we are going to be dealing with specifically this. But I want to remind you that there are good liturgies and bad liturgies, and there are liturgies that let faith shine through, and there are liturgies that obscure the gospel. And we want to make certain as much as possible to have the gospel shining through. Okay, let us move along and ask about, well, let's review, that might be helpful. Let us take a look quickly at our tradition. I talked about this a couple days ago. I argue that our tradition is biblical, Catholic, with a small c, Catholic meaning universal, from the two Greek words kata holon, meaning pertaining to the whole. That's what the word Catholic means. It pertains to the whole of human life, whole of the universe. Biblical, Catholic, confessional — that's the flavor in the soup, the specific denominational flavor. Lutherans have something that's good, and I hope that Lutherans can give that gift to all the churches. Methodists have something that's good, and they should give their gift to all the churches. Anglicans Presbyterians, Roman Catholics, Greek Orthodox, all of them have something to teach all the rest of us. And we should be very humble about this. We should say, look, I think what I have as a Lutheran is terrific, and this is what it is. You tell me what you think you have that is terrific, and I'll take that as well. So, Biblical Catholic Confessional National. We're not the Lutheran Church in Sweden or Germany. We're the Lutheran Church in North America. And that means we have our own opportunities and our own problems. They're different. Parochial, that means parish related. And we want to make certain that we don't, as a young pastor or a leader, come into a parish and say, now from this day on, everything's going to be different. I mean, you have to deal with the parish traditions, even if those parish traditions, you know, are not exactly what you would hope they were. Biblical, Catholic, Confessional, National, Parochial, and Personal. As Willie Loman's wife says, attention must be paid, even to the person, to the very individual. Martin Luther says, given and shed for you for the forgiveness of sins. It has to get to the for you, and you got to believe that, or it won't make any difference. So that's our tradition. That is, so to speak, looking back at what Grandpa and Grandma have given us. And my definition the other day of tradition was this. Write this down. It's going to be on the test. No, I'm kidding. The definition of tradition is this. Giving Grandpa and Grandma a vote in the decisions you must make today. Good definition, I think. You don't want to give them the only vote or the deciding vote necessarily, but you want Grandpa and Grandma to have their say. And more than that, you want to try to honor what Grandpa and Grandma honored. And you want to try to learn to love what Grandpa and Grandma loved. And to be a truly contemporary person does not mean throwing out all that stuff from the past. The psalmist says, sing to the Lord a new song. That does not mean we have to stop singing the old songs. Let's keep singing the old songs. They're great stuff. But let's do it now in our words, in our vocabulary, in our thought forms, in our body language, in our garments, whatever. And if we don't do that, if we don't sing a new song, then I think we're being unfaithful. If we simply try to replicate what Grandpa and Grandma did, that's no good. We want to treasure what Grandpa and Grandma have given us, but we want to sing our own song, a new song. And as I suggested, the Psalms, particularly the Psalms, but all through the history of the Old Testament and through the New Testament and through church history, you have permission to do a lot of different stuff. I mean, the Psalm says, sing to the Lord with the psaltery and with the harp and with the cymbals and with dance, David dancing before the ark. Incense, no reason why we can't use incense. All the senses involved. I made the point a couple days ago that ritual worship always involves all the senses. It involves not just the top of your head. That's the Protestant error. The Protestant mistake is to think that worship is just the top of the head, just words, just left brain. Linear. Doctrinal. Well, that's part of it, but that's only part of it. Right brain as well, it's kinetic, it's emotional, it's imaginational. All of that stuff is wrapped up in worship, and we should not apologize for that. It's good stuff. People are fed at a lot of different levels. And we want to feed not only the complete you, but we want to feed the complete body of Christ, which include little kids who don't know how to read and who can't use words the way grown-ups use them. The disadvantaged to one kind or another, the physically challenged, the deaf, the blind, the aged, the infirm. I mean, that's the whole body of Christ, is it not? If you don't see them there on Sunday morning in your parish, you have to invent them, in my view. You have to pretend that they're there. The body of Christ is this wonderful Catholic reality that includes rich and poor, old and young, slave and free, Jew and Greek, male and female, gay and straight, left wing and right wing, radicals and conservatives. That's the body of Christ. And we Let me tell you, that's the only place in our segregated society where you find that diversity. Kneeling together or standing together at the altar to receive the bread and the cup is the only place where the PhD and the freshman, I mean, I'm on a university campus, right? It's the only place where the PhD and the freshman meet in the world that I live. But they meet there, and that's wonderful. And that's a gift, and we should cherish that gift. Black and white, rich and poor, all of those polarities. Okay, moving along. So, we want to sing a new song. We want to do it in our own terms and in our own vocabulary. How do we do it? Well, I would say that there was a wonderful cultural consensus that began about 1912, 1920, and lasted until last year. Well, until very recently. And this would be called the modern movement. You've heard about modern architecture and modern art and modern music and so on. Now we're in presumably the postmodern period, whatever that means. For the most part, I regard postmodern as kind of neo-Victorian, neo-Renaissance. There's not a lot that's new in postmodern, in my view. What they're doing is taking a skyscraper and tacking on gingerbread, and it looks a little bizarre, but it's kind of fun. I'm willing to live with it for a while. But the modern consensus from about 1912 to 1960s was a very thrilling, exciting thing in music, architecture, literature, you name it. All of the arts had a kind of common voice in those years, and I want to give you five characteristics of that modern spirit. And I myself would be willing to identify myself as a modern person under the rubrics that I'm going to give you. Postmodern, as I say, we may be in a postmodern period, but I'm not sure there's a lot that's new there. What was new in 1912, 1922, a couple years ago, that was new. That was a new thing. And this is what it said. First of all, not romance, but reality. This was a movement that wanted to reject all the Victorian sentimentality and romance that came out of the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, 1900, turn of the century, and so on. That was an era when you found buildings, you know, with all the Victorian gingerbread and the rickrack and the fretwork and all that, and when you had writings like, I don't know my literature very well, but maybe somebody else here might. The purple prose, you know, all these exaggerated and heaped up phrases and so on. In contrast to that, you had Ernest Hemingway, nothing but nouns and verbs. Wonderful language, may I say, very biblical. You can find biblical language. Read the story of Abraham and Isaac sometime. If you want to see a story that could easily go into bathos, you know, or into real terrible, a kind of sentimentality. Here's this guy going to kill his little son. But there's none of that in the telling of that story. Where the little boy says, where is the sacrifice? Here is the knife, here is the wood for the fire, but where is the sacrifice? God will provide a sacrifice, my son. Abraham took his son and stretched forth his hand and took the knife. I mean, wonderful stuff. It's a very lean, Ernest Hemingway-like story. Now, the same thing in architecture. You found the Bauhaus movement. Do you know the Bauhaus movement in architecture? The so-called international style. You see it even today in Scandinavian furniture and Scandinavian design. Very simple. Ordinary materials, lots of stone, lots of slate, lots of natural wood, and everything there very elemental and simple. Nothing exaggerated, nothing too much, rather almost too little than too much, which brings me to the next point, less is more. This was a phrase out of architecture. Less is more, and along with this rejection of romance and sentiment came this idea the less you say, the more you say. Now, surely we want to qualify that, and there are some limits to that argument, but nevertheless, these architects particularly, but you can see it in painting and sculpture and music, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and all that stuff, less is more. That is to say, let us be understating rather than overstating. And you found buildings, again, being built that were very, very simple and very, very elemental, and in my view, very, very elegant, because they were so understated, so simple. A third quality might be this, and this is from Marshall McLuhan. The medium is the message. Now, again, I think I'd want to qualify that. I think I'd want to say the medium is at least part of the message. And this is simply an acknowledgement to church people, for instance, that non-verbals communicate along with the verbals. I gave you the statistic a couple of days ago when we met, 55, 38, 7. 55% of everything you absorb and learn about me when you first meet me, 55% of that is nonverbal. How I stand, how I walk, how I move, the clothes I wear, whether I'm smiling or whether I'm frowning, all that is nonverbal, body language, whatever you want to call it, and it's 55% of everything you pick up. On top of that, 38% is still not words, but what's called vocal. Whether I shout, whisper, and whether I have an inflection in my voice or whether I talk on a monotone without any change and it's very, very boring. You see what I mean? That's vocal. You tell a dog, bad dog, and the dog doesn't speak English, but the dog knows what you're saying and puts tail between his legs and goes under the chair. Same with training children. Vocal. Vocal, in other words, vocal is very important. And that's 38% on top of the 55. What's left? 7%. 7% is the actual content of my words. Now, as I said a couple days ago, that should give a preacher nightmares. Or a teacher, or a parent. I mean, we ought to be conscious of all these nonverbal and vocal elements on top of our words, and sometimes the nonverbal and the vocal can contradict the meaning of the words. And then we're back again with Marilyn Monroe and Norma Jean Baker. The embodiment denying the inner reality. And we want the inner reality to shine through the embodiment, not to be denied by it. So, the medium is at least a good part of the message. Those nonverbals speak. The colors of the church year in paraments and vestments, they speak. And little kids pick it up, and the mentally and emotionally deprived pick it up. You cannot tell me they don't. We tend to be so rational and so top of the head, us Protestants, that we don't realize the power and the persuasiveness of all of that nonverbal stuff. And that means preachers and worship leaders ought to be conscious of all of that nonverbal stuff and how it communicates and what it communicates. Okay, moving along. A willingness to shock. That's a fourth quality of this modern spirit. A willingness to shock out of apathy into insight. I suggested a couple times before when we met this week that we're living in a time of cultural inflation, and we're just bombarded with music in the elevator and in the dentist's office, Muzak and so on. We learn to tune that all out and become very cynical about music and about a lot of other things too. I talked about the grocery store with the box of detergent. You know, it used to be small, medium, and large. Now it's big, giant, and super giant. I mean, that's inflation. That's cultural inflation. And the church should not be promoting that. It should be working against that. Not just the church, but other areas too, in my view. We don't want people to get apathetic. We don't want them to be cynical. We want them to listen to what we have to say, and that means a return to what the theologians call primary realities. primary realities, church with candlelight, the hand upon the head in blessing in a healing service. My conviction is, and it's not just my conviction, but other people too, human beings, particularly Western Christians with all this technology around us, we are starved for primary realities. Want to hear an example of primary realities? I gave it to you a couple days ago, but I'll repeat it. The primitive baptisms in the primitive Christian church were naked baptisms. Talk about primary realities. You took off all your clothes as a sign of rejecting the old life, took off the jewelry, took off your necklaces, let down your hair, whatever. You went into the pool, immersed, totally immersed three times, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three times, came up out of the water and were clothed in a white robe, put on the righteousness of Christ, given a candle, let your light so shine that others may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Oiled, anointed. The word Christ in Greek means anointed. The word Messiah in Hebrew means anointed, oiled. And Cyprian, or one of those ancient fathers of the church, says, how can we call these people Christians if we don't oil them? I wasn't oiled when I was baptized, but let me tell you, the baptisms that I do these days, I oil them. I mean, I think it's a wonderful gesture. You're reminding people of what Luther says, we are to be Christ to each other. We are to be Christ to our neighbor. Neat, huh? I'm supposed to share in that messianic work. I'm supposed to share in Christ's Messiah-ing. Okay, a willingness to shock, therefore. And then finally, form follows function. That's another formula from architecture. Not so much Greek beauty anymore as Hebrew beauty. I explained a couple of days ago that the Greek idea of a chair was that somewhere up in heaven there was an ideal chair, the essence of chairness. And this chair, with its wood and its joints and the screws and so on, it is a successful chair or a beautiful chair to the degree that it reflects this heavenly ideal of chair. That's the Greek understanding. So you had this ideal up in heaven somewhere or in the mind of God or whatever, and the chair was beautiful or not depending upon how close it reflected that ideal. Now that's Greek, but the Hebrews didn't think that way. The Hebrews said, a chair is something to sit on, and if it's something that invites you to sit on it, it's a chair. Form follows function. I've heard of guys talk about a hammer one day, and a pliers, and about the destiny of a hammer, and the destiny of a pliers. The destiny of a hammer is to pound things, and the destiny of a pliers is to squeeze things, and the destiny of a screwdriver is to screw things. And that form, you see, is so dependent upon the function that it serves. And the Hebrew understanding of things celebrates form and function very closely together, almost making it an ethical thing. The beauty of holiness. You know, beauty is as beauty does. You've heard that expression before. Barbara Streisand's nose. You know, my goodness, that's not the nose from a Greek sculpture, I'll tell you that. But can't she sing through it? Wowee! I mean, that's a terrific nose. Anyhow, those are five qualities. I mean, that's a very Hebrew, you know, it's a very Hebrew way of looking at noses. Now, those are five qualities of what I would call the contemporary spirit. Now, postmodern, post-contemporary, I won't get into that. But I'm willing to stake my case with what I've just given you. And I want to turn now to another possibility, and I want to have some time at the end for some conversation. I want to turn to some standards for experimental or quote-unquote contemporary worship. What might they be? I have 12 of them here. And this builds on what I said the other day about entertainment evangelism. We had a session on entertainment evangelism and we did not get to this, and I wanted to, and I'm taking the time now today to get to it. One of the things that I saw in the Community Church of Joy, which is the Mecca, you might say, the Vatican of entertainment evangelism, one of the things that I saw and admired was this sense of enthusiasm in the leaders. They really were turned on by what they were doing. And they radiated that. They had this vital, contagious enthusiasm that what they were doing was fun, what they were doing was important, and they led worship with that spirit. And I thought it was terrific. And I said to myself, boy, if only we could do that with the Green Book. As I said the other day, so often you go to a service and the usher will push a green book in your hand and push a paper pamphlet in your hand, a guide to worship, and push a celebrate in your hand and another bulletin insert with the announcements on it. And what message are they sending? They're sending the message, this is going to be difficult. Furthermore, you aren't going to like it very much. And furthermore, I don't like it very much, but here we are, we got the green book, let's open to page 77. I mean, that's deadly. Isn't that? I mean, that's the spirit you sometimes find in churches. And that green book is terrific stuff. And if we could only have that same vital enthusiasm in worship leaders, I think you could. Hospitable, this would be the second quality. Welcoming the secular unchurched. Now, hospitality is a very difficult thing and should begin before the people reach the door of the church, even outside the building. The building ought to be hospitable and welcoming and cleaned up and not messy and giving a sense of having been cared for and loved. I went to a church college, which I shall not name, and this was in the summer. I have to grant that this, you know, may be an off season. But I went to the chapel in this Lutheran church school, and I was distressed to see the chapel unloved. I mean, it did not give evidence of having a loving concern expressed for it. Again, maybe it was in the summer and they were starting to remodel or something, I don't know, but it looked kind of messy to me. Accessible, that would be the third quality. We want it simple, we want no frills, we want to reduce alienation. I gave you the examples the other day of the Lord Mayor's banquet on the one hand and the barbecue or the buffet dinner out here at Holden Village on the other hand. And the Lord Mayor's banquet, I went to the Lord Mayor's banquet and it was very fancy. And we had, as I say, six or seven forks and six or seven knives and spoons. And we had a fish course and a soup course and a meat course and a different wine with every course. And everybody was all dressed up, in fancy dress and so on. It was a lovely meal, the fanciest meal I've ever had. And it was great nourishment and it was great conversation. But so is this out here. Great nourishment and great conversation. And that's the difference between high church and low church. High church is where you put on all the fancy stuff. And low church is where you have just the basics. And they're both legitimate. And I don't think there should be an argument between the two. I mean, there's a time and a place where at service you want to have liturgical dance and incense and trumpets and timpani and, you know, an ordination maybe, or Christmas or Easter or something like that, swing the incense, processions maybe, banners maybe. I mean, there's a place for that. But there's a place too for a campfire setting with the young people down at the lake, and you pass the bread and the cup around and sing with the guitar. And you're all dressed in blue jeans. But the difference between those two is not, again, in nourishment, not in human companionship, but it's simply dress and deportment and etiquette and what you expect in terms of the externals. You want to interrupt me along the way, feel free. I want to leave some time at the end, however. Contemporary, as I say, we want to have it faithful to our tradition. What Grandpa and Grandma have found helpful and useful, we want to honor that as much as we can. but we also want it contemporary. We want to use our own modern forms, music, language, space, architecture, whatever. We don't have to apologize for that. Faithful, that would be another quality. Loyal to the spirit of the Green Book. I didn't write anything in the Green Book, but I know the people who did write the Green Book. And as a matter of fact, I was on the committee at the national level in the old LCA that had a pass on everything that appeared in the Green Book. In other words, twice a year we would meet with a great big pile of documents and we had to go thumbs up or thumbs down on whether this got into the book or not. And you can imagine there were arguments and rhubarbs and discussions and so on, and I lost a few and I won a few. You know, some things got in that I wasn't too keen on, and other things didn't get in that I wish had, and so on. But this is a splendid book, and it's a book that other denominations wish they had, believe me. This book is the envy of almost every other denomination. It is a splendid, splendid book. Now, it's 15 years old, and it's beginning to show its age. I heard a speech last summer that said the average life of a hymn book is maybe 30 years, so this book is in its midlife crisis. And in a midlife crisis, you don't, you know, run off and buy a Porsche and go around the world. I mean, you try to dig deeper and find out what you've got there that you didn't know you had. Learn to reappreciate what you've already got. So I would encourage that with this book. Find out what's in this book that you don't use and use it. I mean, there's great stuff here. So it wants to be faithful. Whatever we do that's contemporary, I think, ought to be faithful to this book and not teach contempt for this book. We got into that a couple days ago, and we can return to that in a minute if you want to. I think I have experienced some contemporary worship that is presumably Lutheran that teaches contempt for this book. This book is old stuff, throw it away. I think that's a mistake. Participatory, not consumers but worshipers. We talked about this the other day too, how a lot of times our very church architecture mitigates against the sense that we are all performers, we are all invited on stage. Everybody in the pew is invited to be a performer in this event. It's not supposed to be audience watching some paid professionals doing their thing. That's entertainment evangelism at its worst. What it is all of us on stage, all of us participating, all of us performing, all of us singing praises, and the worship leaders, the pastors, the preachers, the musicians, the choir, and so on, they are the prompters in the prompters box. Or maybe they're, to change the image, they're the cheerleaders cheering the team on in the field, and we're all on the field. And it's God who's in the stands. Or it's God who's in the audience. It's not as if the people in the pews are an audience watching a performance put on by professionals. That's no good. That's not worship. Worship is where we are participants. And the worst thing I saw in the Community Church of Joy was even a sense of not simply audience, but even consumer. You know, I'll put my money on the offering plate and it better be a good show. I mean, that's so American and it's so free enterprise. I mean, it's just too consumerist. And I think we should get away from that.
Speaking of architecture, it ended up noticing always in some of the other churches, the ones that are older, it ends up the leader, the minister, or the pastor, like about a half a story above.
Right, yeah. Now, 15 feet above criticism, somebody says, yeah. Yeah, I have a friend in Minneapolis who is a church designer, and he says we shouldn't even put our altars on a platform. The altar should be on the same level as the people.
We shouldn't even have an altar if we get down to it.
Well, a table. You have to have some place to put the bread at the top.
But not in the altar.
Well, I could give you an article to read about altar.
Be on the same level too.
Before there was a table, there was an altar, this article argues, and it's a good article. Anyhow, to altar, table, I'm not fussy. I think both terms are okay. And I like the idea of an altar that looks like a table, because after all, this is the meal of the Lord with the bread and the cup.
Okay, where are we? Mature and not infantilizing.
That's a kind of a made-up word, infantilizing, but again, I have seen some contemporary worship that is exclusively this teenage type of stuff. And the songs are very, they fit a youth group, but they don't stretch you into a maturity in Christ. And St. Paul says we are to grow up, we are to be mature in Christ. And I would go for a certain amount of this. It's lively and fun, but a little of that goes a long way. And if you have nothing but that, it's, sorry if this sounds offensive, spiritual junk food. I mean, you can live on McDonald's hamburgers, but I wouldn't want to make a diet of it. Furthermore, some of these quote-unquote gospel songs are very narcissistic. They, you know, it's me and Jesus, and I have the Spirit in my heart, and this is what I'm going to do for God. And the great hymns in this book are objective. This is what God has done. Now, you have to have subjectivity too. Kierkegaard said that truth is subjectivity. So it has to be for me. I mean, that's the personal level down here. But nevertheless, we don't want to keep people infants. We don't want to keep people immature. We want to stretch them into a maturity. That's why I would say it is not necessary that everything in the service be accessible immediately. There ought to be something there in the service that you don't get right away. There ought to be something in our worship that suggests a mystery that you can grow into. And if that sense of mystery is not there, then I think we're gypping people. We want to provide worship that is accessible, yes, but we also want to balance that accessibility with durability. It wants to last in the long run, the long haul. And it wants to suggest that there's more there than you know right now. Have you ever seen the poster of Corita? Any of you know Sister Corita, Mary Corita Kent? Graphic artist, a Roman Catholic sister, as a matter of fact, died a couple years ago of cancer. Wonderful artist, and she has a book of posters with this wonderful graphic design that says something like this: to understand is to stand under, which is to look up to, which is a good way to understand. In other words, we ought to approach this with a certain humility. There's something there that I don't understand. I'm standing under it. I'm looking up to it. And I'm willing to learn from it. Isn't that nice? I mean, I like that. There should be something about our worship, and something maybe about our church buildings, and something about our theology, who can tell, that suggests there's more there to learn than you know right now. I tell seminary students when they come to seminary, by the time they leave seminary, they ought to be able to tell me the difference between metastatic eschatology and anthropogenic eschatology. Now, if you don't know the difference, you've got some homework, right? There's nothing wrong with using your left brain too. I mean, there ought to be something to grow into, and there are shelves of books in that library that stretch your mind and stretch your imagination. Read them. Sacramental. That's my eighth suggested standard. I would even say this: if you have a second service and it wants to be contemporary or different from the main service, you ought to have the communion there at least as often as at the main service. If you have the main service communion four times a year, then there should be four times a year at this other service. If you have it once a month, it should be once a month at this other service. If you have it every Sunday, it should be every Sunday at the other service. I would even argue that maybe the experimental or the unusual service or the contemporary service or whatever you call it could
lead the way and be a pioneer for some people in having communion more frequently. Let's take a little survey just for fun. How many congregations four times a year communion? Look at that. Boy, I bet 15 years ago you wouldn't have seen that. How about once a month? Most of you. How about every other week or twice a month? Look at that. How about every Sunday? Wowee, look at that. Marvelous. Including Holden Village, right? I mean, every church ought to be, every congregation, every denomination ought to be moving toward the apostolic Catholic consensus, which is communion every Sunday. That's the Catholic consensus. And we ought to be moving our parishes and our congregations in that direction. And yeah, further, go ahead.
Not to use that argument because you just shoot yourself in the foot.
Tell me.
Well, because there's a suspicion as soon as you introduce apostolic, uh-huh. You know, right now going on, that you just shoot yourself in the foot. You'd be better off.
It's too
just,
Catholic.
Yeah. So you'd be.
Use another argument.
Yeah. I would. Yeah,
maybe so. We should not, I hope we can train our people to be comfortable with that term, Catholic.
Well, I don't just mean Catholic, I also mean apostolic right now. That's a touchy word.
Maybe you know something I don't know.
Well, I think with some of the ecumenical dialogues, and that's kind of a buzzword right now to use apostolic, it's kind of come out of the Episcopalian dialogue and the state for ministry.
And it's suspicious to some people.
Yeah, real suspicious. So that can be a negative word.
I see. Well, early church, maybe I'll use that.
We should never be doing these things simply because
somebody else does. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
a bad argument either. But a lot of people think this way, you're right. And we should be sensitive to them and try to nurture them and bring them along. And when you change people's piety, that's what you're doing. You're changing people's piety. When you change people's piety, you're really screwing around with something very deep and precious and important. So you want to do that with kid gloves. You want to do that very carefully. Anyhow, sacramental, not word reductionist. I got this feeling when I was at the Church of Joy in Phoenix, Arizona, this entertainment evangelist church, that they understood worship to be words. Words read, words preached, words prayed, words sung. Whereas words are part of it, surely, but it's also the people participating in a common action, not least eating and drinking and digesting and metabolizing. I suggested that a couple days ago. What does the sacrament add to the word? Metabolism and molecules. You see my argument? I mean, it's not just my argument. It's the argument, I think, of the historic church. That is to say, God wants to meet you at the level of the molecules, your metabolism. And not just your molecules, but the molecules of Copper Mountain and the Amazon rainforest and the hole in the ozone layer and all of that. I mean, that should give us a justice, a push towards justice and a push towards ecological awareness and ecological concern, the fact that God is concerned about the molecules. It's not just left brain. It's not just words. It's not just ideas or ideals or principles. It is very real stuff. Hungry human bodies who need to be fed, and the Amazon rainforest that needs to be protected, and that's the little moth up in the northwest here that they're trying to protect, or is it a butterfly or a bird or an owl, the spotted owl, that's what it is, the spotted owl. I mean, all of that is part of our mandate. Ecumenical, exhibiting the current Catholic, Orthodox consensus. Inclusive, inviting to all sexes, races, ages, classes. Post-literate, I would even say post-literate, requiring no reading or literacy. Again, so much of our service, so much of our worship is book-bound. And you go to a Lutheran church and everybody's got their nose in a book.
When I have a baptism, for instance, or a wedding, I say, put the book away. I need the book, you don't. I'm the one who's paid to read and paid to be literate, and you don't have to be. You just watch at this wonderful action. We're having a resurrection in front of you in this baptism. That's what a baptism is. It's a resurrection. Now you should pay attention to it. Post-literate. Edifying the body, we want to edify the whole parish and not divide it. I would also say post-technological. That's a big one, but as I made a speech earlier, I won't make it again. Every little country church in my part of the world has to have a PA system. I mean, a church that's a room as big as this and they have a PA system. Outrageous. Carpeting on the floor. Well, I've made that speech, I won't make it again. Let's quit here, my speaking, and let's talk.
I think work with ecumenism within probably metropolitan city areas are in that work of understanding the church denomination. But I've seen going over to Chicago every other year is that more or less the smaller towns and smaller communities seem to not want to dwell within ecumenical work or dealing with other different denominations.
Mm-hmm. That's a pity, don't you think?
Yeah, ended up with a comment I was going to make. Uh-huh. I know in Seattle I worked with the Church Council of Greater Seattle, and we work with the mainline Christian church denominations. When I've been over to Chicago talking to other communities and other people, the smaller communities don't seem to want to work with other denominations.
Hmm. Yeah, I would regard that as a pity, because we have so much in common, and it's being brought out in a way that we haven't seen for 400 years, as I said a couple days ago. I mean, this is an exciting time to be alive with this ecumenical agreement. We ought to be working together, even in a small community.
Kind of a subjective kind of a comment
sure.
on my part with regard to worship, and then that leads into the question. A lot of times when I'm worshiping the Lord, I'll click into the whole business of thinking about God and saying my songs to God and reciting the songs to God. And it's a conscious decision that I make to think about God and direct all my activity at any given moment toward God. And what I call that is worship at that particular point in time for me personally. Okay. Is there a shift in the composition of Americans, say from one generation to another, where one particular kinds of forms in previous generations enabled them to click into that kind of mode where you think about God, whereas today, now, we need different kinds of forms to cause people to click into God, if you know what I'm mm-hmm. saying there. And is there any, can you make a comment about
that? Yeah, I think the answer to that question is yes, it is different. Let me use King James Bible as a sample. The so-called authorized version, or the King James Bible, is very beautiful, and it's almost altogether incomprehensible to a lot of modern people. These and thous and beseech and vouchsafe and all these ancient ways of speaking that were very comfortable for our grandpa and grandma, but people just don't speak that way anymore. So this book and most of the new worship books have done away with that so-called Shakespearean language or Tudor language, and they're putting it all in modern language, even some of the hymns. So yes, I would say if you were to have a service these days, and the Anglicans have a much bigger problem about this than we do, because they're English, of course, and they love Shakespeare, and all of that is part of their literature and their cultural tradition. So, oh boy, to see Anglicans accepting the new language, that's very, very difficult for them. Not so difficult for Lutherans, because we've been speaking German or Swedish or Danish or Norwegian or whatever, and you know, English is a second language for a lot of us, and so it's easy for us to make that change. But Anglicans are having a very difficult time weaning their people away, teaching their people now to use modern language instead of the old Shakespeare language. But I think the Shakespeare language turns a lot of people off, and I think the new language does help people click better.
Would you say contemporary music? It seems to me
same
that
thing.
A lot of the argument revolves around contemporary music. Would you say that contemporary music, just by virtue of the structure musically, and I don't know what I'm saying there, but the structure musically helps people click into
a
mindset of God?
Dissonance and a little bit of syncopation and stuff like that, and you can find some of that in this book. Including in our liturgical stuff. The first setting has some neat little syncopations, and that's modern music, believe it or not, in the first setting. And some of the hymns have modern harmonizations that are a little bizarre. As a matter of fact, we have some criticism because of that. But country and western is another story. You know, that's modern music, I suppose. But, well, is it really modern? It's probably 1890s more. Anyhow, yeah, sure, we have to write hymns in modern music and modern words, modern poetry. But again, I'd want to qualify that a little bit. And I wouldn't want to throw out the old stuff. Go ahead.
Well, I'm glad you said that last thing. That making value judgments on what is worship music or words. And I would differ with you very strongly on most, or I don't remember what proportion you said, of the King James Bible is incomprehensible. I think I would argue that point quite strongly.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, and I have said many times, that what a lot of people want in worship music or words, the young couple who refused to go to church Lenten services in our church during Lent because we didn't use the right words for the Lord's Prayer anymore. And that type of thing. What a lot of people want is a warm, nostalgic experience.
Yeah,
and I have said you can get the same experience from a warm bath. They want in that. But on the other hand, I think it's still a very legitimate thing for some of our older people to say, those hymns, those songs, don't touch me. Now, I'm not going to be able to stand in judgment and say, you're just looking for a nostalgia trip, or your need is real. We're talking about a number of generations that need to be dealt with in each worship service, if possible, or at least in successive worship services. And how in the world, to go back to what I said the last time, can we expect people to be ecumenical, to want to accept, even think of going and accepting something from another church or joining with them, when we haven't even been able to do that
ourselves,
to accept diversity within our own church? And the reason we can't is because we've taught them for so long that there's only one way to do it. It's got to be this way. Then we say, well, let's join with this church. Well, they're different. Well, that's okay. No, it isn't. You taught us that there's only this way to do it. It's either right or wrong. And the reason we've done that, and the reason we're having problems, is because we're so afraid. And why are we afraid? Because we're basing our salvation on the form of our worship.
Marilyn Monroe and Norma Jean Baker,
And the more people that disagree with us, they're threats. Because if they're right, I'm wrong and I'm not going to be saved.
Yeah.
But if I'm secure in my own salvation, then the fact that you wish to worship differently from me is no longer a threat. I can accept you and your methods of worship, your music, for you, because it speaks to you, and what I need speaks to me, and we can
we can accept each other.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. We ought to be able to, I would want my friend to learn what I love, and I would be willing to learn what my friend loves. And if my friend loves country and western or whatever, I would count it as my responsibility somehow to try to learn to love that. And I would hope it's their responsibility to try to learn to love the German chorales, let's say, or plain song. You know, that's very foreign to most of us. The German chorales maybe and the plain song is different and difficult. But I think we owe it to ourselves to try to learn that. You know, I heard this expression, people say, I know what I like. They really should say, I like what I know. And it's what you become familiar with when you were a kid or grown up with, you know, and it's comfortable to you, and that's what you like. So it takes some stretching to learn something new.
Paul, I'm just curious how much extension you would give to this idea of we need to learn from one another. I had experience to talk to some folks on the board up here 2 weeks ago when they were here, and I suggested that at least to shape the world that I'm living in, I'm having a lot of confusion about the milieu in which a third of God's children are finding Him and how their experience with that religion, Islam, is affecting my life. And is this, I mean, there's a third of the world doing this. It's hard to imagine if God hasn't fallen in a ditch that somehow He's not involved with the experience of a third of His children. And I said, you know, what about next summer just bringing a mullah in here for a couple or 3 weeks and talk to us about points of, you know, we are the people of the book. They say nice things about Mary. They say nice things about Jesus. Why did they feel so badly about us as a people? You know, we should at least struggle for some common ground. And these people looked at me like I suggested that we make him the village pastor and build a minaret on the where would you say, I mean, is that a legitimate, how do we as Christians explore our relationship with even other non-Christians in this increasingly diverse and interdependent world?
Yeah, I would affirm that ultimately. I think we ought to be talking with brother and sister Christians first. Then probably second, we ought to be talking to Jews, because we are all honorary Jews. Christopher Stendhal says that. We're closer to Jews than we are to Muslims, but eventually we ought to be talking to Muslims, and we ought to be talking to Hindus and Buddhists too.
Well, we're killing more Muslims, and they're killing more of us. So yeah, Lord have mercy. Made more sense. You don't kill your brother to please your father.
Yeah, yeah.
And
terrible.
Just seemed to kind of
back here.
As I understand it, there are some churches that practice what they call non-believer worship. That is, they have a worship service for the believers, and then they have a worship service for people who do not believe in Jesus, but are it's
seeking.
I guess you call it seeking or evangelistic or something like that. Is that possible, or how do you understand worship by non-believers? And here in the Northwest, 90% of the citizens of the state of Washington have no affiliation with the church.
Yeah, I've heard that.
What do we do?
How many percent?
90%.
Is it as high as that? I knew it was highest in the country, but I...
says that they're committed, they have a committed Christian relationship.
Wow.
1 in 10.
Yeah, I would think it'd be very difficult to have non-believers worship. Whatever worship you have, you're illustrating some belief. And if you aren't worshiping the God of Abraham and Sarah and Jesus, then you're worshiping some other God, I think. So I don't think I would go in that direction personally. I think I would have a frankly, if I were to begin from scratch, I would have a frankly Christian service. In fact, it would be Eucharist. Did you ever see The Mission, the movie The Mission? Jeremy Irons, you know, what does he do? He goes off to Central America or South America or whatever it is, and he says Mass. Now, he's only got a couple of little Roman Catholic brothers with him, but pretty soon some of the natives, you know, they get catechized and they get baptized, and then pretty soon some more, and by this, remember they're singing this beautiful song for the bishop when he makes his visit. I mean, I think that's what we ought to do. We ought to go into a foreign land and say Mass. That is, celebrate the Holy Communion.
But these people don't have the tradition that we
right. have. We got a big educational job ahead of us.
Confessional is
yeah.
you know, they don't know what Catholic or confessional
yeah.
is. That
yeah.
stuff is.
I think we just have a big educational job ahead of us. But I wouldn't shirk it.
But if you go into a foreign land and say Mass, which language would you use?
yeah, Jeremy Irons used Latin. Yeah, yeah. I would try to use their language, sure.
So then I also think we should worship God in the language we use every day. And it's been very hard for me to come to this country and have to learn a new language just to worship.
Sure, it's always difficult. And it's even difficult for English speakers to make the switch, you see, from King James to modern English. And as I say, the Anglicans, particularly the Episcopalians, have a terrible job with that because they are so, they love so much that Shakespeare language. So it's almost like the difference between Danish and English. But I think we have to do that, and one of the reforms of the Second Vatican Council in 1963 was the first Sunday in Advent, 1963, every Roman Catholic across the world had the Mass in the vernacular for the first time in hundreds of years. Martin Luther was arguing for that 400 years earlier. And then in 1963, it happened. So, again, that's a lot of hard work. We should probably...
My understanding is I have a very novel understanding of that the church is like the Church of Joy. Is that the church that you mentioned?
Church of Joy, yeah.
Those kinds of New Age churches are the ones that seem to be having phenomenal growth.
Oh, yes, very much
throughout
so.
Throughout our country.
Very much
they're
so.
They're not New Age at all.
No, they're not New Age. But they're mega churches, or they have this entertainment evangelism thrust.
Okay, well, what's New Age then?
New Age is crystals and Shirley MacLaine and stuff like that.
Okay, so whatever you would call.
yeah.
Well, what would you call a church of?
Well, entertainment evangelism, I suppose. Mm-hmm. What would they call it? Seekers worship or, you know, something like.
But I mean, those are the churches.
They're growing, right. Yeah. I'll tell them how they can grow even faster. Invite Madonna. I mean, is that what you want? See, that's the question I would ask. In other words, is it success at any price? I think the price they're paying is too high. It's not Eucharist. It's not participatory. It's very much a consumer kind of thing. I think they're buying into everything that's bad about American culture. This is my critique of it. Now, I have some kind things to say about it, and I did a couple days ago in my presentation here. I had some nice things to say about it, but basically I'm critical of it.